Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Well, the rain has finally stopped falling and we have this morning, ladies and gentlemen, something of a spring in our step. We have returned refreshed from a lazy weekend, safe in the knowledge that our hard work is beginning to pay off. All last week, I was campaigning for the forgotten victims of this COVID pandemic, the hardworking men and women from the small businesses that make this country great and make it what it is. All last week, I was urging the government to bring us a kind of roadmap out of the lockdown that is killing so many livelihoods and so many formerly vibrant communities. And this morning, it looks as though all the noise we made is beginning to pay off. Government ministers acknowledged over the weekend that restrictions would have to be filled and lifted, and that we now need a plan to do so. And Nadeem Sahawi told Julie Hartley Brewer exactly the same. Precisely is what I would say. Now we can crack on with defining just what the causes and effects of the lockdown are so that we can plot our escape. So Desmond Swain put it best with Julie Hartley Brewer this morning. It is, after all, a matter of urgency. We'll be checking in with John Rentoul, chief political commentator from The Independent. There's much to discuss, much to talk about. Hope in the post for an awful lot of people. We're told that 5 million vaccinations could be handed out very, very shortly. We're told that by February the 15th, the top four vulnerable groups should all have been covered by the vaccination. So let us make a plan. Why not? 0344 499 1000. Peter Hitchens joins us too with his latest take on those attacking lockdown sceptics and changing them into COVID deniers. Plus, we'll talk about the now row surrounding Lord Sumption and his appearance on TV yesterday. Is one life worth more than another? As ever, of course, we need to hear from all of you out there because we need to know what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and what you are being told. We need your eyes and ears as well. And quite frankly, if you want to tell me that you're very concerned about loads of people going to a park, I'm not interested. If you want to tell me that Matt Hancock shouldn't have been playing rugby in the park, I'm also not interested. 0344 499 1000. If you can't go anywhere else, you go to a park, don't you? It was a lovely day yesterday. I was at the beach down in Sussex. It was absolutely mobbed. Crazy, crazy busy. But I wasn't going to start reporting people for going out in the fresh air by the seaside to walk where there's quite a lot of wind. Coming up later on, we've got Simon Calder on the latest complications on negative testing for travel, and Charles Ray will be here with the latest from the world of Harry and Meghan. Plus, can your employer force you to have a vaccine or indeed a test in order to come to work? And Tory MP Andrew Rossendale wants us to set up plans for the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, which takes place next year. We'll also be bringing you the news that 25,000 patients have caught coronavirus in hospital since September. That means they didn't go in with it, but they got it while they were there. That's one in six. We've been asking for that figure. Also, we'll be telling you why every 30 seconds another COVID victim is admitted to hospital. Where are they all going? You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, I must confess, I had a rather busy weekend batting away lots of mad lefties who seem to be very obsessed with how I look, how I dress, what I say, and why I'm on the radio and not on the television. Well, unfortunately for them, I am on the television. I'm on YouTube, I'm on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter live streaming. So you can watch me, even if you don't like the way I look, you might not like what I say. But just watch it anyway, because then we'll all make more money. Let's talk to John Rentoul, chief political commentator at The Independent. John, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike. They don't like the way I look either.
I know, isn't it extraordinary? I get you on here for many reasons, John, not least your very sharp intellect, but also your magnificent library and bookcase behind you, which looks, is one of the more fabulous backdrops to anyone that we get on this show.
Well, that's all right, but my face apparently looks like a vampire, so I get an awful lot of...
In some parts of the world, that's considered to be very attractive.
Well, I mean, in this part of the world, I consider it to be all right, yeah.
Listen, there's nothing worse than people with ugly views and ugly kind of nasty things to say, which is unfortunately what Twitter seems to have now become exclusively. It used to just be like that occasionally. Now it's just like that all the time. But let's not talk about Twitter because it's not important enough for us to even consider in terms of weighing up what the people of this country think. But, you know, there is a sense this morning, I think, that you know we're beginning to win the vaccination battle. Certainly, Sir Desmond Swain this morning was saying that he's looking now for a kind of a route map out of here, as we were asking for last week. What's your take on it?
Yeah, no, I think the most important thing is that the level of infections seems to be declining quite sharply in London and the south and the east in particular. And, you know, as the vaccines roll out, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. And as you said, I mean, if we can vaccinate the top four priority groups by the middle of February, give it 2 weeks to take effect, then by the end of February, we should be in a position to ease some of the restrictions. And I think that's an entirely good thing. I was a bit worried that the Prime Minister last week seemed to be suggesting that, oh, no, we won't be able to ease the restrictions that much because, you know, it's still serious for younger people. But I think I think the debate will start to tip in the direction of easing the restrictions.
Yes, because I think, as Desmond Swain said, it's important now to kind of look scientifically at the lockdown, because up until now, it's always been a bit of a blunt instrument, and almost everyone, even those who are in favour of lockdowns, are not in favour of them, if you know what I mean, because they know that they're a bit of a blunt instrument. But it would be good if it could become more refined, wouldn't it? And sort of you could say, well, look, there's obvious, like we know, for example, this morning from Public Health England, that 25,000 people have been infected in hospital since September.
Yeah.
I think once we can start kind of nominating and finding out where people are getting the infections from, you know, then we could perhaps open up other areas.
Well, I think there's certainly a case for moving to a position where people are more able to choose for themselves whether to protect themselves from the risk, given that, you know, with the vaccines spreading, it means that, you know, it will be less dangerous. So it was interesting, the German foreign minister for some reason just popped his head up yesterday and suggested that people who've been vaccinated should be allowed out to go to the restaurants and theatres. Mm. I mean, I don't know who's actually going to serve them and put on the shows, but I think that is a debate that we will need to have in this country as well.
Yes. I mean, I think in terms of who serves them and who puts on the shows, people presumably who consent to do so. Because in the end,
yeah,
there are going to be lots of people who are willing to go back to work who haven't worked for almost a year because they need to.
Exactly. And I, you know, I mean, I think the risks for young people are still incredibly low. And I think, I mean, I'm certainly of the view that, you know, once you've protected the elderly and the vulnerable, I think that is essentially job done. Mm. I mean, obviously, there are complications, but I think we should be looking to open up society and the economy as quickly as possible. And, you know, looking to do that at the end of February.
Yes, because I think at the end of the day, we need to get the economy going again. I mean, there are lots of people that I talk to who have gone through all sorts of terrible mills in terms of, you know, opening, closing, reopening, closing, getting stock in, watching it, you know, go to waste, all of that. I mean, I was talking to somebody last week over in Borough Market, and they're actually quite optimistic, but they all say, as long as we've got some idea of what, you know, what we have to prepare for, you know, we can probably survive. And in fact, some of them were even saying, actually, there were so many tourists coming here towards the back end of 2019 that we actually prefer it this way because it's now become a local market for local people, which is a kind of interesting way to look at it as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, no, I think that all that is true. I think the, you know, there's still a potential danger from new variants of the virus, which are resistant to vaccines. Which is something you've got to look out for. And that's why I think it's so important to have the machinery in place, in particular to quarantine people at airports when they arrive. I'm not saying we need to do that all the time, but we need to be able to have those measures ready if there are new variants that pop up somewhere in the world that are vaccine resistant. Because I think that is the main threat for the second half of this year. But you know, I mean, if you listen to the people who know what they're talking about on Sage, you know, they say that there are new variants occurring all the time, but the risks of one which is resistant to the vaccines is not particularly high. So I think we need to press on full steam ahead and try to open up society and the economy as fast as possible.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think most people as well would agree that when the Brazilian one was discovered, the government actually did act uncharacteristically quickly to stop flights coming in, not only from Brazil, but from places where Brazilians might have flown to then come here. But the interesting thing for me is that as long as you're going to try and lock down the country, it makes absolutely no sense to have people arriving in it from all parts of the world without being checked.
That's not strictly true. I mean, it just depends where the new infections are coming from. If the new infections are coming from within the country, then it doesn't make sense to close down the borders until you've got the infection right down to low levels. But I mean, I think after vaccination, that is no longer an important issue, except for new variants which are vaccine resistant. And as I say, I don't think we need to worry about them too much. We need constant vigilance, obviously, but I think we need to focus on getting the country back to normal.
Yes, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, interestingly enough, you know, the Neil O'Briens of this world, who seem to have become like sort of, you know, COVID evangelists overnight, who suddenly, he's described by other Tories as Matt Hancock's house elf, which would be a terrible phrase to have to repeat in one of your columns, John, but I wouldn't want to put that in your head. But the point is this, right? Here's a guy who now says that all COVID deniers, as he calls them, who are not actually COVID deniers at all, keep getting it wrong. Well, I mean, I'm sorry. There are very few people in the whole COVID pandemic who got anything right, aren't there?
Well, that is a fair point. But I do think Neil O'Brien is an excellent MP who has done an extremely good job.
Why has he suddenly become an evangelist on behalf of COVID, though?
Well, because I think there is an awful lot of misinformation online.
Yeah, and he keeps drawing attention to it.
Well, he keeps rebutting it, which I think is very important. I think it's important to point out that...
Yeah, but he's not rebutting it in the way that I would rebut it if I was a very good MP, because what he's doing is he is tarring many, many people with the same brush. I mean, you cannot put Julie Hartley Brewer in the same boat as Ivor Cummings. So it's just not right. You know, Ivor Cummings is a bloke selling diet pills. Julie Hartley Brewer is a very well-respected political journalist.
Well, true, and I don't agree with calling people COVID deniers either. I don't like. I mean, that's a phrase borrowed from Holocaust denial.
Yeah,
I think that's
it's not helpful.
That's,
is it?
That's rhetorical and over the top. But given all that, I think Neil O'Brien has done an absolutely sterling job of exposing some of the sloppy reasoning and arguments that have been pushed online by people who are opposed to the lockdown for political reasons but don't have any alternative.
Yes, but there are also plenty of sloppy examples on the side of government as well. You know, we've had Patrick Vallance, we've had Chris Whitty say all manner of different things, and all of which are available to watch as they made those statements previously. But we don't do that constantly, because the whole point of this pandemic is that it has moved remorselessly from one corner of the room to another and then back again in a different form. You know, the fact is that there's an awful lot that we didn't know about this back in March. There was an awful lot that we didn't know about things that we know about now. For example, the fact that we are being considering making mask wearing compulsory in the street, when Patrick Vallance was quoted earlier in the year last year as saying that masks were not actually a very good idea.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously knowledge has changed.
Yes, what I mean.
Still an awful lot we don't know about coronavirus, but I don't think you can equate anti-lockdown conspiracy theories with some of the possibly unwise things that Sir Patrick Vallance
yes,
and Chris
but you see, you've fallen said. Into the same trap again. I'm not talking about the conspiracy theories. I'm not talking about the... I'm talking about the journalists, and I count myself as one, who have been sceptical about some of the lockdown measures. And I really don't think it's fair or indeed ethical to lump everybody together.
Fine. I mean, no, I don't think it is either. But I think anyone who has questioned the lockdown and the restrictions has to propose an alternative policy, and I think that's the weakness of your position, Mike.
Well, I've proposed plenty of occasional policies. If you wish to have them, I can give them to you and roll them out for you anytime you like. You know, there is no evidence, for example, that shows that a COVID-secure restaurant or bar, which has got screens, which has got staff wearing masks, who are serving people at tables only in a very quiet atmosphere, there is no evidence that that spreads COVID at all. So I have suggested...
I'm not sure you're right.
Well, I am sure I'm right, because the evidence of infection, the evidence of infection is no more than 3% coming from those hospitality areas. And you can go and find those figures if you wish. However, in hospital, it now turns out, one in six people who are infected with coronavirus got it when they got to the hospital.
Yeah. No, I think that is a real problem. And, you know, obviously not enough was done to deal with the problem of infection in hospitals. Mm. But again, it's difficult to know, you know, what are you proposing as a result of that statistic? Are you suggesting that people shouldn't go to hospital?
Well, no, but that would be the argument of those people who think lockdown is a great idea. Shut the hospitals, that's where it all is. That's my point, is to point to the ludicrousness of those kinds of conclusions being drawn. Because you can't close the hospitals, can you?
But no, people... good. Well, I'm glad you're not proposing that.
No, thank you very much indeed. I'm not that stupid.
That's excellent. So, in which case, I mean, you know, obviously that figure is important and worrying. But
right.
I mean,
let us by that same argument, John, talk about schools, which I don't think should be closed. Okay. Now there are ways of protecting schools. I realise that schools are a much more dangerous place than pubs or restaurants because they cannot be made as COVID safe as either of those hospitality venues.
Yeah.
And yet we are looking at them and saying, oh my goodness me, there's less infection in schools than there is in hospitals. We can keep the hospitals open, but we can't keep the schools open.
Well, you don't have a choice about hospitals because you've got to treat people.
Well, I don't believe we should have a choice about schools either, because kids are suffering massively. Mental health is on the increase. People's teenagers are absolutely going insane, and we're just letting it happen.
Yeah, you and I agree on that, Mike, actually. I mean, I think, and to be fair, I think the Prime Minister and even Keir Starmer agree on that. They're very, very...
I don't think Keir Starmer knows what he thinks.
Well, but, you know, the Prime Minister was, I think he was forced by the seriousness of the situation, particularly the new variant, which spreads more easily, to take a decision he really didn't want to take, which was to close schools, because although it is, you know, it's obviously absolutely crucial that we protect children's education, you know, they are places where the virus does spread between households. And I think the Prime Minister...
Well, you're asking me for solutions. Why not vaccinate teachers? There's a solution.
Well, that's not the problem. The problem is children exchanging it and taking the virus to different households. Vaccinating teachers is...
No, that's not true, because the teaching union said that they couldn't go to work because it was too dangerous for them. So once they're vaccinated, it won't be dangerous, therefore they can go.
Well, yeah, but I mean that means you're going to be putting teachers ahead of the queue, ahead in the queue of more vulnerable older people.
You just roll out more vaccines, John.
Well, the point is the vaccines have to be delivered in some kind of order, priority order. You can't just sort of decide to deliver them to everyone.
Yeah. You make it sound as if I'm the first person that suggested this, John. I mean, there are plenty of MPs who think vaccinating teachers is actually a good idea. And I'm saying that if you want to find ways out of it, you can't ask me for solutions and then poo-poo every solution I give you.
Well, I can. I can ask you for solutions.
Typical independent writer.
I can point out why they're wrong.
Yeah, you'll never be in power, so you don't have to know what it's like.
Well, yeah, but I'm actually quite sympathetic to people who are in power and have to make these difficult decisions. And I think they make most of those decisions for good reasons. And now, I think, you know, although it's our job to criticise them and point out other possibilities, I think actually on that one, you're wrong. I don't think vaccinating teachers is a good idea.
OK, well, I'll hold you to that when we come back to that, when somebody decides it is a good idea and they actually do it and then they reopen the schools. But let me finish with something even more surprising for you, John. I'm going to be in agreement with the Labour Party here on this argument this afternoon about universal credit. It makes no sense whatsoever for the Tories to take it away, does it?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, they are going to concede that eventually, I'm sure. I mean, I think Rishi Sunak in the budget, which will be coming along in March, will actually agree to to extend it. I don't think he'll extend it indefinitely because, you know, he's desperate not to set that precedent, not to raise the level of universal credit permanently, which is why he's come up with this this scheme to sort of buy off the dissent by giving people a lump sum for worth.
That's
worth
an idiotic idea, isn't it?
Well, no, that's one way of sweetening the pill, isn't it? You say right, I'm going to put the universal credit back down to the old level, but you know, here's 6 months worth of the £20 a week. You know, that's quite a good way, it seems to me, of trying to end it. But I mean, it's not going to work. It's not going to persuade anybody.
Well, I heard one Tory MP this morning who's in favour of actually keeping the payment, saying that giving that money in a lump sum is very unconservative.
Well, it's a device. It's a way to try and achieve the cut. But it's not going to work because, I mean, I think the problem is that what the coronavirus crisis has exposed is how low the levels of universal credit really are. And I think that's only sort of just sunk home to people. And I think it's going to be very difficult politically for the Conservatives ever to reduce that £20 a week rate.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's probably right. John, thanks very much indeed, as ever. We shall join you again soon, I'm sure, to another very, very stimulating conversation to kick off Monday morning here at Talk Radio. 0344 499 1000 is the number. As I said, we are live streaming on Facebook, on Twitter, and on YouTube as well. That's where you want to be. Go and sign up to it. Go and subscribe to it. We're going to get loads and loads of other videos about around for you. We're going to do Plank of the Week this week, of course, as well. All sorts of things going on. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Time to say a very good Monday morning to Mr. Peter Hitchens. Peter, how are you?
Well, so far so good, Mike. I won't make any greater claims than that.
Yes, well, I think that we could all be thankful for that. I mean, I suppose it tells us about the kinds of times we're living in. When I was watching the arrest of that Russian dissident as he arrived back into Moscow yesterday on the news, your visage came into my mind, and I wondered if at some point or other in the next 12 months we'll be seeing you arrested for similar crimes against the state.
Let us hope not.
Yes, let us hope not, absolutely. But ridiculous that it would even occur to me that that's where we are, because over the weekend, Neil O'Brien, MP, he seems to have appointed himself as, you know, sort of a COVID evangelist in chief, having a go at people, calling them, moving now away from the conversations about lockdown scepticism, now actively calling journalists COVID deniers.
Yes, this goes on, and it simply impels me to go back to my original point, from which I have not shifted since March, which is that whatever else you may say about this event, the action of the government has been wholly disproportionate to the problem and has deeply damaged the country. We now see talk of a wealth tax, so-called, which would actually be the most tremendous raid on the middle classes and all the savings they've piled up over many years of hard work and thrift, which is one of the ways in which we may have to pay for the catastrophic decision of the government and unprecedented, I should say, decision of the government to shut down the country. I would say again, these things have happened before. We're told the only comparison that we can make is with the 1918 to 1920 so-called Spanish flu. But there have been two similar influenza epidemics in between that, the 57-58 Asian flu and the 68-69 Hong Kong flu, so-called. Both of which don't apparently show up in the statistics quite as strongly as they would because they span 2 years rather than one. But these have happened before, and no government ever before, and indeed the World Health Organization opposed the sort of actions that we have now, the quarantining of the healthy, the shutting down of economies and the destruction of lives by poverty and loneliness and deprivation of medical treatment, which is taking place on an appalling scale. So that is the point that I've made from the start, and I stick to it. It doesn't matter when anybody calls me or anything else. I have not denied the existence of COVID. It's a ridiculous and stupid thing for anybody to do, and I wouldn't dream of doing it. And the expression, as I say repeatedly, is a dog whistle smear designed to equate legitimate dissent with the revolting Holocaust deniers. And I just think that people who do it are behaving disreputably.
Yes.
And frankly, anybody who's a member of parliament who behaves in that fashion should look carefully at the rules of Parliament itself, which prevents this kind of behaviour in its chamber and should quite rightly influence the rest of us outside. I'm not going to respond personally to it, but I think that anybody who takes this view is discrediting themselves the moment they say it. Mm. I do try in all this argument to be fair to my opponents, to assume that they have good motives and that their intentions are good and kind, and I ask only the same in return.
Yes, I think that's absolutely fine and absolutely fair, and you're quite right. You have been very consistent from the beginning when you and I first disagreed to the point we have now reached where we more or less agree on an awful lot of it. I mean, one of the things I'd like to see, and this is what Sir Desmond Swain was asking for this morning on Julie Hartley Brewer's show, was an actual proper kind of scientific analysis of why the lockdown has worked, in which parts of the country has it worked, in which businesses has it worked, and what the benefit has actually been of closing down the economy. And I think that's a very legitimate question to ask at this point.
Well, it is a very legitimate question to ask, but you won't get an answer because the government knows perfectly well what the answer would be. It's not justified. The damage done is wholly out of proportion to any good which may have been done, and there is still absolutely no evidence that these lockdowns do any good at all. So many surveys, good objective surveys of all the countries which have undertaken these measures or haven't round the world, come up with the same answer over and over again. There is no evidence that closing down your country reduces the number of deaths, and yet people persist in doing it, even though it's never been done before. And
well, the only places we are told about where they've had successes are Australia, which in fact closed its entire country down to anybody coming into it, and of course locked down people with curfews and all manner of things, similarly as they did in Vietnam. However, they didn't do that here because that's not the way that we locked the country down. So our version of a lockdown isn't the same as anybody else's. And when you are challenged on this, people will say, oh, but that's not true to say lockdowns don't work. Well, this lockdown doesn't work, and that's a very big difference.
No, I would go further than that. You look at places like Australia, it's you've presumably been there, and I have.
I haven't actually, no. I don't think I'm going to get there either before I die.
It's an incredibly long journey, and it is way off all the major national travel routes. Australia has done itself, I think, great economic harm, as has New Zealand, by the policy it's adopted. But we don't actually know that the lower incidence of the disease in Australia is the result of these actions that have been taken. And you could equally well say that Antarctica or the Falkland Islands or Tristan da Cunha or St. Helena or Ascension Island or any of these largely unvisited places have had a great success with COVID, because I'm sure their statistics are also low. But the reason might actually be simply a matter of geography. So let's not attribute causation to something which we don't yet know. What is certainly the case is if Britain had tried to behave like Australia at the beginning of this, it simply wouldn't have been possible. Being where we are, a major transport hub off the northwest coast of Europe with enormous amounts of travel to around the world and particularly also to North America, it simply would not have been possible.
And with enormous amounts of trade passing through the ports of this country and the airports of this country.
Well, that is also true. The whole thing here remains. I mean, there is no evidence that there's no evidence of correlation, and there's no evidence of causation, and yet people keep doing it. The same is true, of course, of the face coverings issue. The evidence for their usefulness is scanty to the point of non-existence. But the presumption of all media, all politicians, and indeed and the public is that they work, so people wear them. And there is a complete retreat from rationality and the scientific method going on.
Well, there's also a complete retreat from many of the statements that were made by public health officials in this country at the start of the lockdown, in which they professed to say that mask wearing was not going to be made compulsory because there was no evidence that it would actually help.
True enough. But that's just it. I tend to feel that we are in the group of something very closely resembling superstition here at the moment. And I would much rather, for the sake of the country and the people, their health, their lives, their sanity, all the things which are being worn away at the moment by this unending ordeal, if we actually readopted the scientific method of serious experiments and hard, testable evidence from it, and based our actions on that. I genuinely think that if we pursued a more modestly targeted but more scientific approach to this disease from the start, we would have had fewer deaths. And I don't think, if people say, well, if people would only take the lockdown more seriously, then more people would survive. I don't think that that's necessarily true. And also, I am appalled by the way in which people keep accusing the public of not abiding by the rules. I go about a lot. I see almost nobody not abiding by the rules. Compliance is an extraordinary. I think the government is preparing its excuse and its get out for the failure of its third useless lockdown. Mm. And when it fails, we'll be told, oh, well, you went out for 10 minutes more than you should have done. You had more exercise. Yeah. You breathed harder than you should have done. One person in 20,000 didn't wear a mask in Tesco's. As is nonsense. Mm. If the lockdown worked, these things would be trivial side issues. If it doesn't work, they make no difference.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, we know
blame the public in advance.
We know several things today that we didn't know before. I've been asking the question for quite a long time. We've now got from Public Health England a figure of 25,000 people who have been infected with coronavirus in hospital since September. They got it when they went into hospital. They didn't have it before they went in, and then they got it. So one in six people in hospital is actually infected by the hospital itself. Now, the logic of the lockdown fanatics would be, therefore, you shut the hospitals. But, of course, that's not what we're going to do. The other one is the propaganda arm.
Let's make a small point about that.
Yeah.
Problem here. It's been back in the days of New Labour, when John Reid was health secretary, there was a huge difficulty of MRSA and C. difficile hospital acquired infection.
Yes,
which is a problem to some extent of the kind of huge hospitals we have, which are simply not designed, for instance, for isolation. If you have lifts visiting every floor, then you can't really isolate any floor from the other in any effective means. We used to have, and I suppose there must be some surviving, quite a large network of isolation hospitals where the sick were quarantined. Mm. But now we have hospitals which are almost bound to be exchanges of infection. And it's very difficult to make sense of these figures because, first of all, of the nature of testing, which looks only for COVID. And secondly, because of the fact that anybody who goes into hospital is quite reasonably tested for COVID, we still don't really have a clear idea of exactly what most of these figures mean. But it's absolutely true, and this also happens to doctors and medical staff, that the most likely way of obtaining the infection is almost certainly to go into a hospital. And then there is the other thing, which I keep stressing here when we're told that things are bad in hospitals, which I don't doubt, is that the enormous amount of self-isolation by NHS staff who've tested positive greatly reduces the number of people available to treat those who are ill.
Yes, right.
And therefore the proportions of numbers of ill people and numbers of people available to treat them have been seriously skewed by this.
Yes. There could be as many as 30% of the frontline employees of hospital wards unable to work currently because of a mixture of those two things. And that's obviously also the reason they give us for not being able to open the Nightingales. But I read, I don't know whether you did, a very interesting piece by Robert Hardman, who visited the Royal Free Hospital in North London, which was searing and terribly upsetting. And obviously, it's a terrible situation in many places. But here's another anomaly for you. You know, the sort of the propaganda arm of the NHS, Sir Simon Stevens, said, just to sort of alarm everybody, that every 30 seconds, apparently, there's somebody admitted to hospital with COVID. Well, if the hospitals are all full up, what are they doing with all these people?
Well, I've puzzled over that statistic, but I haven't yet managed to get to the bottom of it.
I think it's right. It's saying that it accounts for about 20,000 admissions a week, which is about right. But that means there must be space for them.
I haven't worked it out. But what also interests me is this other very, very important thing, is that I think quite a few people are now recovering from COVID in hospital.
Yes.
But they can't be transferred out of hospital if they normally live in care homes. So very large numbers of people remain in hospital, even though they have, in fact, recovered. Mm. And we still haven't got reliable recovery figures on this matter. And it's difficult. I tried at the beginning of this to be extremely rigorous about obtaining figures from the government departments and NHS departments and all the rest of it. And I found that over and over again, I asked questions in a form which they weren't prepared to answer. They would send me the figures in. And if you've ever wrestled with statistics, you'll know that it's crucial how they're arranged in the first place, whether they're actually answering the category that you want. I found it almost impossible to penetrate the maze of statistics in this matter. And I also felt there was a strong unwillingness on the part of the authorities to give stuff which might undermine the message.
Yes.
So I can't establish this for certain. It certainly felt that way.
Yes. Certainly there's no doubt, Peter.
It's also been noticeable that some of the institutions which had previously been providing what might be called independent sources of slightly different information seem to have got rather quiet lately, a thing which I find rather puzzling. I don't quite know why.
No. Well, there's no doubt that since the advent of the Blairist Information Commissioner and the Freedom of Information Act, it's actually been more difficult to get information out of them, because what they've managed to do rather cleverly is to completely box in all of the ramifications of asking a particular question and lining up any sort of possible answer that would make any sense. And what they're very good at doing is now saying that they can't answer a particular question because the amount of money involved in finding the answer would not be worth doing.
It's also the round the houses trick, yeah. Where you ask the Department of Health, they say no, it's the NHS. The NHS say no, it's Public Health England. By the time you've gone around all three of them, they've all referred back to the place where you started. Right. The week has come to an end. I just got so, and if you ever do get any other, it's a fire hydrant.
Yeah. Oh no, it's the same. It's the same.
It's the same. Find it in here, Buster, if you can.
Yeah, it's the same strategy they use in the local council to make you pay your parking ticket. By the time you've exhausted all the various appeals, you've worked out actually you might as well just pay them because it's just a lot simpler.
It's beaten down. Yeah, I know. The only point I made to you is that the statistics which we now have, I think, I'm not questioning the accuracy of the figures, particularly the death figures, which are beyond doubt. It's the interpretation of them, which is very difficult to make in the absence of facts, which I certainly haven't been able to get hold of.
No, sure. Now, as per the information I gave you on Twitter the other day, I'm trying to organise an interview, a debate, actually, really, a sort of head-to-head between you and Dan Hodges. And the reason it's proving difficult is partly due to the restrictions that we currently live under. I would rather do it in person because I think that's far more worthwhile rather than doing it on Zoom, because apart from anything else, it's much easier to interrupt both of you if you're actually in the room, because otherwise, what I don't want is to have a sort of two people talking over each other constantly, which might happen. So that's the only reason for the complication. Dan has since said that he'd rather not do it in person. I assume he has some reason for that.
I think he may, but I think the thing is, if Mr. Hodges wants to do it remotely, then I'm very happy with that. And I can see there are logistical difficulties with getting us all into the studio, which we don't need to discuss, but which are there. And if it suits him, it suits me. And I am prepared to make an absolutely very firm self-denial on this. I think the way to do it would be very much to do it in a parliamentary form, where you are Mr. Speaker.
Yes.
You give permission for each of us to speak, and we address you rather than each other.
Yes. I think that would work. And we'd have to have limitations on the amount of speech as well.
I think we would both very much want to make it work. Mm. And I think that if we could make a remote program work if we try hard enough, and I'm very willing to make that effort.
Okay.
And you can remind me of that if I break those rules.
Well, listen, I'm very much appreciate that both of you want to do it, and so we will make it happen. But just give us a little bit of time, and we'll try and get it on, as it were, quicker, sooner rather than later. Let me ask you, Peter, about the row. I don't know whether you're familiar with it that erupted over Lord Sumption's remarks at the weekend, where he was involved in a television debate about the efficacy of lockdown, etc. But it sort of turned into a whether one life is worth more than another conversation, which is a little bit of a tawdry take on it, in my view, because I don't think that was what he was saying. But all he was saying, really, is what the NHS quite often uses as an indicator as to what they do and how their policies work.
Well, I'm distressed for Lord Sumption. Oddly enough, I was asked to be on that programme, but I couldn't. It was recorded on Saturday, and that's my main working day, so I wasn't there. I'm distressed for Lord Sumption. I think that the problem is that the words actually spoken as spoken can certainly be made to take the interpretation which has been given by his enemies. I don't actually think that's what he meant.
No.
Say or what he meant, but you're once that kind of thing has happened while you're explaining, you're losing. My own deeper criticism of this is that I have always tried to stay away from this idea that we can sacrifice anybody for anybody else. I actually am rather debarred from taking that view because I am a practicing member of the Christian Church, and as far as we're concerned, everybody is made in the image of God, and no life is more valued than any other. I couldn't even begin to say that anyway. It's never been my point that we should sacrifice the old for the young. And I know that some people on my side have taken more or less this view, some of them rather, how should I say, firmly. And I've never really wanted to say that or thought it.
No.
I return to what I said at the beginning. My argument has remained from the start. This is a mistake. It's out of all proportion, and it doesn't work.
Yes.
It does terrible damage to the lockdown itself. Does terrible damage to the lives of people, above all, the healthy old. who have been deprived by this of all the happiness and joy of life. And in many cases, I think, have aged terribly as a result. And I think that's probably the most catastrophic. And also to the young going through education who can never, ever recover what they have lost in the past 9 months.
Yes, no, I absolutely agree with that. And I think it's another example of the wrong argument being deliberately misconstrued, if you like, by people who would like to damage those who are trying to make a completely different argument by sort of painting them as monsters, creatures of the dark, and people who, you know, want you to make a choice between your grandmother and your child. It's just simply, I think, misleading and pretty despicable, really.
Well, I think it's a shame, but I think it characterises the nature of this argument, which has become, on many occasions, very personalised and bitter. Partly because I think it's always the case, in my view, that people with a bad argument will turn to attacks on their opponents to keep people from noticing that their argument is bad. I think the argument that I've advanced has always been a good, a kind and rational argument based upon both the scientific method and on a sensible analysis of the real costs of the country. And I've got a lot of abuse for making it. Well, I'm used to that. But I regret it because it means partly that the argument has not been properly heard and that the government has by and large been able to ignore this. And I now pretty much accept that I've failed to make any impact on this policy will now be run through to the end, whenever that might be. I'm more interested in two things. One, the past, in establishing what actually did happen. And secondly, the future, making sure that whatever we do, if we have an event like this again, we don't do this again.
Yes, I think that's a very fair conclusion. Peter, thank you very much indeed. And I think we have made some impact over the course of the last few weeks, particularly when it comes to how to get out of this particular lockdown that we are now in. Because last week I was asking for a roadmap. This week it looks as though the government is going to supply one. And it looks as though government ministers are going to supply one for March the 8th. And as of 4 points from there. Because in the end, you know, all we can do is ask questions. In the end, all we can do is try to influence the policies that are being made by government, because that's what we are here for. And I'm not going to be beaten down by some Tory MP who thinks that he knows everything now about a disease that hardly anybody knows everything about. This is Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We've got much to do and plenty of time to do it. Mark Dolan coming up at 4 o'clock, of course. We've got Ian Collins coming up at 1. A Plank of the Week is going to be underway pretty soon. And I'm afraid, even though they missed out on it last week, I have to say that Harry and Meghan might be making it back to it this week. We shall see. Let's talk to Charlie Ray, former Royal Editor, of course, of The Sun. Charlie, I'm going to say Happy New Year because I think we've spoken to you this year, have we?
No, we haven't. Happy New Year, Michael.
I don't know how that's possibly happened. I don't know how you could have slipped through my fingers and had to wait until now, the 17th of January, in order to, or is it the 18th? I can't remember. Anyway, listen, apparently Thomas Markle is back in the news. Tell us about it.
Well, what's happened is that apparently Thomas has made a new documentary, which is about his life, but needless to say, is going to be featuring unseen videos and photographs of his beloved, or not so beloved, daughter, Meghan. Now, this is due to come out, I think, sometime later this year. Mm. And it's going to be very, very interesting. I'm a bit surprised that Thomas has not used his daughter's own company, who's now a media company, and is planning to make documentaries. He's not chosen her company to produce this one.
Right.
Now, in it is going to explain from Thomas, you know, why the relationship went sour and, you know, how he supported her all the way through. And let's remember, he has not seen his grandson at all, and nor has he met his son-in-law.
No.
Harry in any shape or form. So this is going to be quite interesting, this documentary, coupled with the fact that we've got this court case that's due to come up later this year. In fact, there's going to be a bit of a preamble of it in, I think, about 2 or 3 days time,
right,
in High Court in London by Zoom. So we'll find out whether the case actually goes to the thing eventually.
Yes.
You know, so.
Well, because I was going to ask you where we are with that, because I know that there's already been a couple of preliminary hearings, haven't there, where bits of Meghan Markle's requests have been chucked out, basically, and she's been thought to have kind of lost the early stages of the case. She also rather, I thought arrogantly, asked the judge if they could just get a decision without him hearing any of the case at all, which was an interesting approach.
But this is what's happening in the next couple of days. This is the summary. This is the application for a summary judgment, where she's basically saying that you know she's right and the Mail on Sunday are wrong. She obviously doesn't want certain documents to be released in public, nor does she want her five friends who went to the People magazine anonymously to be called as witnesses.
No.
So this is her attempt to get the case resolved in her favour without actually it being held, you know, in an open court.
Yeah.
And we'll have to wait and see whether it's granted or not. I'd be surprised and staggered if it is granted, but you know, we all know what the law is like. It sometimes amazes you how decisions it makes.
Yes, indeed. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's yet another lawsuit in the offing, thanks to this Thomas Markle documentary, because presumably she'll do her level best to get onto my learned friends and ask for some kind of injunction to be put on any kind of stuff that he wants to produce, which she hasn't okayed.
I'll be surprised if she's not talking to the lawyers about this documentary, because presumably she'll know certain things that will be in it, and it'll be another vehicle and another platform for Thomas, you know, in effect, to reveal just how awful the relationship has now got between both Meghan and himself. So I'll be very surprised if she's not talking to Sue Grabbit and Run at all, and see if she can try and stop this documentary. It'll be amazing. I mean, it's going to be great television, this documentary. Even just for the bit, all we want to know is about the bit about Meghan. Let's be honest about it. I'm not interested about his lighting career and how he lit.
No, I mean, the idea of that Thomas Markle, a guy that who nobody would have ever heard of, apart from the fact that his daughter happened to marry into the royal family, wants to tell us about his love for filmmaking. Not really. I'm sorry. I haven't got time really for that.
Just get to that bit about Meghan, please.
I mean, has he done a deal yet with it? Or is he, do you know what the plan is?
I'm not sure. I think he's just announced that he's doing it. So I'm not sure who he's done the deal with or where it's going to be. I suspect it could well be Channel 5, who seem to be getting all these great documentaries just recently about royals and other matters. They seem to have taken over from, you know, BBC Two for, you know, quite good television.
Yes.
Good
Yeah. Well, do you know what I would counsel him if he was to ask me? Whatever you do, don't sell it to Netflix, because they'll be buying it on her behalf, never to let it be seen.
No. I'm sure it's going to be on one of the mainstream channels.
Right.
There's no way it's going to be tucked away anywhere.
No, I think there's too much of a money making sort of opportunity here for a TV company, and that's what they like to do. Let's talk about another royal scenario, because an extraordinary story in the Times this morning from John Simpson, their crime correspondent, aides to the Duke of York and his former wife contacted a woman said to be an internet troll in an apparent effort to discredit his accuser in the Jeffrey Epstein case. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it?
Absolutely extraordinary. And this is a story that cropped up in the Mail on Sunday yesterday as an exclusive. And this is a woman called Molly Sky Brown. And we have to say that she herself says that there was an attempt to recruit her as a masseuse by Ghislaine Maxwell, you know, the so-called lady pimp, allegedly, of Jeffrey Epstein. Now, this is an amazing comment that we've come across here, that two aides of the Duke and Duchess of York contacted this woman because she has been trolling Virginia Roberts, basically saying that Roberts has been lying and she, you know, was a a manipulator and everything else, and was also suggesting that the very famous photograph of Prince Andrew with his arm around her was fake, even though we now have a situation where experts in photo manipulation have said, this is not a fake photograph. This is a genuine photograph.
And that's the one that shows Ghislaine Maxwell in the background, isn't it?
That's right. She's in the background, and it was taken at her home. Now, the aides of the Duke and Duchess of York, and interestingly, it's the Duke and Duchess of York, not just the Duke of York, contacted this woman and amazingly suggested that she set up some sort of scam Twitter account to try and force details out from some of the victims, including Virginia Roberts, and also one of the baits that they use, according to her, was that one of the aides even suggested that she'd get the best wishes from the Queen. I mean, it's absolutely
incredible, isn't it? And this is all on WhatsApp messaging, according to the story, through some character called Mark Gallagher, who is not one of the persons involved in the exchange, but supposedly is one of the advisors to the Duke of York, that this person was trying to get involved in this case.
And she was initially contacted by, I think, it's someone called Amanda Marshall, who is an aide to the Duchess of York. I mean, whose recollection of this discussion is vastly different to what this Molly Sky Brown is saying. Mm. But still, you know, this is a sign of, if this is absolutely true, and I'm hard to believe that it's not true, this is a sign just how desperate the Duke of York is to try and get this, you know, put away. He's actually wants to try and recruit people to, you know, in effect, bad mouth or, you know, put away various people who've got allegations against him.
Well, of course. But there's a very simple way of putting the allegations to bed, and that is to talk to the FBI and explain to them why they're wrong, isn't it?
You're right. It is, and absolutely. And he should be speaking to the FBI, as we've discussed on a number of occasions, because, you know, there's a lot of people. We're all doing nudge, nudge, wink, wink. There must be something there. He's trying to cover up something. And that's every time we come to this story, like today, we get another sign that, you must be trying to cover something up here. There's no smoke without fire, you know. It's just incredible that he's still defying, even though he said in that very famous, awful Emily Maitlis interview, awful for him, not so bad for her, that he was prepared to cooperate. Well, he's not being prepared to cooperate. He's going behind the scenes and he's trying everything he can, you know, to get out of this mess that he's got himself in.
Right. Also, Charles, you and I know from our various political and journalistic careers, and I say political with a small p, you know, there's an elephant in the room. You can't keep ignoring it. You can't just pretend it isn't there. And every time he does anything, even if he walks into a breakfast with his mother, he must be thinking, I hope she doesn't ask me about that thing in America, you know?
Well, exactly. And it's, you know, and his brother, the future king. Yeah. What brother think every time he sees him, if he does see him? I mean, he's now been, you know, taken off royal duties. He's very much in the background, but he's still very much a boil on the royal family's bum, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there's no question about it. And it needs to be Lance.
Yes, very well put. I couldn't end the interview any better. Charles, thank you very much indeed. Charles Ray, former royal editor of The Sun, a boil on the backside of the royal family. I think that's the greatest description of Prince Andrew yet. This is Talk Radio. It's the only place you'll hear that kind of talk.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. What a start to the week it has been. And I have to say, you know, this time last week, I wasn't feeling particularly full of the joys of spring. But this week, I am. And despite the fact that today is meant to be Blue Monday, it's meant to be the day when everybody's really, really depressed. But I'm not at all. I'm, in fact, quite, shall we say, encouraged by the fact that we seem to be certainly doing the job with the vaccinations. Let's talk now to Andrew Rossendall, Conservative MP for Romford, because he wants to talk about the royal family. Andrew, very good. Good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, I've disgracefully shown my age by saying I remember the Queen's Silver Jubilee. I remember it very well. I was 17 years of age and I came home and my father said to me, have you ever heard of a group called Queen? And I said, yes, I certainly have. He said, well, I've got three tickets to go and see them tonight at Earl's Court. And it turned out that the next door neighbour was in their lighting crew And Queen did this massive concert at Earl's Court on the Queen's Silver Jubilee 1977. And it was absolutely fantastic, brilliant, all of those things. I'm hard to believe that the Platinum Jubilee is next year. How many years does that mean then?
Well, Mike, I remember the Silver Jubilee as well. I was a small boy and I went up to London to watch the parade. And I remember it was a magnificent day in June of 1977. Shows how long ago that is.
Yes, it certainly was.
Since then, we've had a Golden Jubilee for the 50th. We've had the Diamond Jubilee for the 60th. That was 10 years ago or 9 years ago. And so next year, we're going to celebrate the Platinum Jubilee, which is the 70th anniversary of the Queen acceding to the throne. She's the longest serving monarch in history. I think she's the longest serving monarch anywhere. And she's certainly the longest serving British monarch. So
yes.
70 years is certainly going to be something to celebrate in a big way.
It really is. And so you've got yourselves a all-party committee group sorted out. What is that going to do exactly? And what are you hoping that will happen?
Well, look, we've had a very gloomy year, and this year is going to be maybe better, but still a bit gloomy, let's face it. We've gone through a pretty bad period. So we hope that 2022 is going to be a year of celebration, not just because we're going to celebrate the Queen, but also because hopefully we're going to be out of this dark period. So I think that all organisations, not just Parliament, but every organisation should think about how we're going to make 2022 a great year and tag this on the Queen's anniversary. So we've set up a parliamentary group, cross-party, and we intend to roll out lots of activities and celebrations, but also to promote within our constituencies the importance of the monarchy, the importance of our constitution, and also to celebrate the service of Her Majesty the Queen, which frankly, if you look at what's going on in other countries, aren't we glad that we have a monarch rather than a president, someone that represents thousands of years of history and continuity and also is above politics and isn't just another politician seeking votes. So
no,
I think in this country, we should be really proud of the system we have.
And what about the Commonwealth? Is there a role for the Commonwealth in that? And I mean, the trouble, I suppose, for an awful lot of what the Queen would have done in those previous Jubilee years is that she's now probably a little bit too old to be doing too much in terms of travelling and appearances and that kind of thing.
You're right. And I don't think that the Queen will be travelling all around the Commonwealth as she has done for previous Jubilees. But I think other members of the Royal Family hopefully will be able to do that. But we must remember that the Queen is also head of the Commonwealth. That's 54 member countries. And she's also still head of state of 16 of them. So Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Jamaica, and many other smaller countries all still retain the Queen as their Queen as well, in the same way that we do. And then, of course, there are the British overseas territories like Gibraltar and the Falkland Islands and Bermuda and the Crown dependencies like Jersey, Guernsey, Isle of Man. They're all going to celebrate because she's their Queen too. So this is not just a British celebration. This is a celebration that's going to take place across the world. And of course, we have expat populations in countries and nation cities all over the world, and they will also be seizing the chance to celebrate this great occasion.
And would there be, is it a kind of a street parties theme you're looking for, or is it more ceremonial than that?
It's both. Clearly, local communities will hold, neighbourhoods will hold street parties, local village parties, but also schools and churches and community groups will get together and organise special occasions, whether they be parties or some other kind of tribute event during the year. But in terms of Parliament, traditionally, we have always given a gift to Her Majesty. The last Jubilee, the Diamond Jubilee of 10 years ago, we collected money and we had the stained glass window in Westminster Hall redone with the Royal Coat of Arms. So I'm hoping we can also come together and give the Queen a gift, a lasting tribute to her. Something like that in Parliament. And if you remember also Big Ben, the clock tower was renamed the Elizabeth Tower. If you remember that, that was suggested by my colleague Tobias Elwood and that was accepted. So
Could I urge you at least to get the cardboard taken off it for the Jubilee year?
Yes. Well, I'm really hoping that the work on the tower will have finished in advance of next year. And I've got a feeling it will be. I think they said 4 years, and I think we're coming up to that now.
I mean, I really think it's time. You know, I mean, I know that we don't have very many tourists at the moment, but when we were down in the tent of common sense for so many months of 2019, you'd see these tourists emerging from Westminster Station, looking up and going, "Where is it?" You know.
I know. I've had them stop me. I've had tourists stop me and say, "Can you tell us where Big Ben is?" And I point. It's very sad to see it, and it was uncovered. I agree.
Actually, speaking of that, what's the story now with the House of Commons and the renovation? Because there was a lot of talk. It's probably now before COVID, because I've now lost all sense of time, and I can't remember when anything else was actually discussed. But there was talk of you guys having to move somewhere while the renovations would take place. Has that sort of been put on the back burner?
Not a lot has been said about it recently, but I think there is a plan in place. And although I can't give you the exact date, I think that we will still be moving out. And I think the plan is that that's going to happen after the next election.
Okay.
The next election is 2024, so it's still a long way off. And I think probably 2025, 26 is the time they're going to move us out. And I believe that the House of Commons will move to Richmond House, which is the old Department of Health, which is just near the cenotaph in Whitehall.
Yeah, I know it well. But, I mean, presumably they'll have to renovate that, because it looks like it's been lying empty for quite a long time.
I think it is being renovated. And I think they're creating a sort of artificial chamber, which is going to look exactly like the current House of Commons chamber. So we will have somewhere to go. But the fear is that it's going to be many years before we come back to the actual place, which will be great, great sadness. But I think that the work has to be done. Look, that building's been used for so many years, hundreds of years. Well, 150 years, more than that. So I think it is obviously necessary to do some major refurbishment.
Yes.
And hopefully we can come back and it will be there for another 100 years.
Absolutely right. Just if I may ask you about where we are right now, a couple of things have come up this morning. The vaccines minister was on with Julie Hartley Brewer this morning, Mr. Zahawi, talking about how he was in agreement with the idea that we must now try to look for some pathway out of the lockdown. It could be that it's not until March the 8th, possibly, but certainly I think it's worthwhile now for the government to look at what could be lifted, what restrictions could be moved, whether it's gyms, whether it's schools. Are you in agreement with that?
Yes, I am. I've always believed that we needed a balance to this whole thing. I don't disagree that there needs to be strong restrictions to protect the vulnerable and to limit the spread of the virus. But the idea we're going to stop it completely, I don't think that's possible. And I also think we have to ensure that we have an economy to go back to, because the knock-on effects of continuous lockdowns are going to be devastating. And I think people underestimate what's coming down the road, unfortunately. They're looking at the problems we're facing now with COVID, and rightly so, but they're not thinking about the consequences of these very severe lockdowns. So I'm always of the view that the government need a balanced approach, and the sooner we can safely restart the economy and reopen certain businesses and gradually get things moving again, the better.
And just finally, on the universal credit debate today, we had a call earlier from a listener who said that, because I'd said earlier, and rather uncharacteristically for me, Andrew, I have to say that I'm actually in agreement with Labour on this. It seems like the wrong time to lift this particular £20 and get rid of it. But it just doesn't seem that the timing of it would do anything other than make everyone think that the Conservative Party was full of very horrible, nasty people who don't like the poor. But I had a call from a veteran who's in receipt of disability benefit and what he called legacy benefits. And he says it's unfair because they don't get the extra £20. And that does seem a bit of an anomaly.
Look, Mike, the situation is this. The Labour Party will always argue that we should be spending more money on everything. There will never be a time when, however generous the Conservatives are and however sensible we are in how we're trying to manage the nation's finances, they will always go one step further and say, well, we should spend more and we should keep benefits higher than they actually are. Government has to be prudent and responsible about how we're going to use public finances. We're already going to be in the worst debt in the history of this country. However, I believe that anyone in genuine need should be given that support. So the £20 should remain for those in genuine need. What I'm not keen on is that we have blanket benefits for people that don't actually need it, who will then go and spend it on the wrong things. I think that we should target benefits. Labour would spread money around like confetti. We know that, but then we get the debts afterwards. I think Conservatives have to be compassionate to those who are in genuine need, but I think we also have to be very careful about the money we're spending and the debts that we're heading into. So I think, again, a balanced approach is necessary. But I have reason to believe that the government are already moving on this and that some of the scares that are being put around at the moment will prove to be unfounded.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, the thing is that at the moment it's difficult to make an argument to not spend money, isn't it? Because so much money is going out to all and sundry, that apart from, say, one or two, unfortunately, groups that have been left out to the side. But basically, it's very hard to make the argument that you need to stop spending money unless you stop spending it in all sorts of places.
Yes, but... You know, everyone can come up with reasons for spending money. I can think of lots of things I'd like money spent on at the moment, make a case for it. But, you know, nothing, there's nothing new in the world since COVID in terms of money that just appears. It still has to be earned. So if we are talking about spending money, it's no good just saying give more money to all these different things, which are all good causes. If we don't also consider the implications of how that money is going to be financed. Because I have to say, Mike, that some of the people that will be shouting the loudest for more and more and more money to be spent at this point will also be the people who will have to take the consequences for the debt that we're going to hand to the next generation. So especially younger people who think that it's you know, we should be spending more and more money on things, they must also realise that it's that generation that are going to have to pick up the bill.
Yes.
So absolutely. I think this generation has responsibility to be prudent and not to spend money that we don't need to spend.
Okay. Good to talk to you, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed. Andrew Rossendale there, Conservative MP for Romford, talking about a great many things, including, of course, the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, which kicks off sometime soon in the next year or so. I had a couple of interesting tweets on it, but how about this from Music Man? I do not want a single penny of taxpayers' money spent on any Jubilee celebrations until we are completely out of lockdown for good and this country is back to normal. Not a new normal, but normal. Then maybe we can celebrate. Well, for heaven's sake, I hope we're out of it by then. 2022, we're talking about. We just entered 2021. It's like a year away. I'm sure that things will look an awful lot better by then. Trust me on that. This is Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.